The more we practice, the more we actually enter into just receiving experience moment after moment, the more we begin to kind of just recognize that we have no idea what is going to happen next. Our usual way of meeting the world, often this is not at the forefront of our minds. And this kind of truth, this truth that we don't know what's going to happen, we can connect with this on kind of the bigger level, the more ordinary level, we could say, the level of accidents and illness. There's so many people that wake up on a given day and don't come to the end of that day alive, not expecting, you know, nothing in their morning that points to this. It's just a moment. Something happens. A device in the system of an airplane fails, and the plane crashes. Someone turns a corner and walks across the street, and the car doesn't see them. Or earthquakes, tsunamis, floods, natural disasters of all kind. These things happen. One famous Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, there's a place in that text, in that story, where one of the characters in the story is asked, what is most amazing? And that character responds, this is what's most amazing. That every day people see and hear about other people dying, and it doesn't enter into their heads that they too are subject to this truth. Only the surface mind understands, he said. The actual sense does not penetrate. And this truth of impermanence at this really obvious level can be such a profound teacher for us, that we don't know when we will die. How does that affect us? How does that change our presence in the world? If we really understood that any day that could happen to us. The Buddha has a saying from the Dhammapada, something like, Very few people realize that we all must die. For those who do realize this, and again, this is at the deeper level of understanding, for those who do realize this, quarrels cease. It's pointing to the way in which it cuts through triviality. To understand this truth at such a deep level, it can cut through even, you know, mental snits. One day I was washing the dishes at my sink and was having some kind of little, like, frustration or annoyance, something not terribly large, but in that moment, you know, noticing this and being present. And I mean, it wasn't like trying to do mindfulness in a really intensive way, but there was enough presence of mind to notice that mind state and recognize it. And I had been contemplating death recently. And the thought arose in my mind, if these are my last moments on earth, is this how I want to spend it? And immediately, all of that stuff just fell away. So sometimes even just the reflection on that not knowing, the, you know, kind of beginning to penetrate, you know, even that, just that reflection, because in the days prior, I had just been reminding myself as I walked out of the door, you know, might not come home tonight. Don't know. And it arose, that reflection arose in a moment and had a deeper effect on my present moment experience. To just take that in. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how long I'm going to live. Do I want to waste my precious moments of life like this? With this annoyance? To me, this death contemplation, this kind of reflection at this more obvious level of not knowing, this kind of death contemplation is not depressing. It really is enlivening. It supports an appreciation for what's here. It supports an appreciation for the gift of this moment. And how does this gift want to be held? Really, we can think about our lives as a gift. And how do we treat gifts? Precious gifts. We take care of them. And our life, you know, really our life is precious when we are with it, when we are aware of it. Another quote from the Buddha. So it might even be the same kind of chapter. Something like, mindfulness, and this is completely paraphrased because I can't remember the words of the translation I'm thinking of. Mindfulness and awareness bring us into life. Those who are not aware are as if already dead. And so this gift of life that we are given, we value it by being aware of it, by being with it in this way that we are exploring. That is a way of valuing this gift of our lives. And so this truth of not knowing, that we don't know what's going to happen at these more obvious levels, you know, aging, illness, death, the kind of contemplations on impermanence that the Buddha offers us. We should reflect daily. I am of the nature to age. I am of the nature to sicken. I am of the nature to die. Everything that I love will become separated from me. Just reflecting on these truths of impermanence at a very ordinary level. The Buddha encouraged us to do this, to just help this truth begin to penetrate our minds. And yet as we practice also at a kind of moment-to-moment level, we also begin to see, particularly as we meet, experience moment-to-moment, that we don't even know what's going to happen in the next second. The next split second. As we begin to really meet this moment and recognize, you know, this truth that we have no idea what will happen in the next moment is often obscured. We don't recognize that because we think we know what's going to happen in the next moment. I mean, probably 10 seconds from now, I'm still going to be sitting here giving this talk. The leaf blowers, maybe they'll stop. But, you know, that this is kind of like, we don't expect anything dramatic to happen. And largely this is true. I mean, largely this carries on. And so I think that kind of The fact that so often what we expect to happen in the next few seconds is what happens in the next few seconds at these kind of more obvious levels of, you know, yes, I'm still going to be sitting here giving this talk. Leaf blowers, maybe they'll stop. But the largely there is kind of a sense of that. I mean, it's not like we just go poof or something. I mean, it is possible that one of us could have a sudden stroke or heart attack in the next moment. And that would be unexpected. And so the kind of normal way that we live our lives, kind of knowing or thinking that we know the next things, that obscures this truth that just moment to moment things are unfolding and we just have no idea what the next moment will bring. That kind of just simple, subtle idea of the next few moments will be about the same as the last few moments. And then we, you know, we have an intention, an impulse to do something. And we kind of, you know, okay, I'm going to get up and go have a cup of tea or something. And we create an image in our mind, you know. It's like we have that impulse, and often there's this like little picture of in our mind. We're down in the dining hall with that cup of tea. And that becomes a kind of a projected reality. And we expect that to happen. Now, the specific details may be a little different. Maybe somebody's at the tea urn and you have to wait, or, you know, things like that. But largely, you know, we kind of feel like we know what's going to happen. We have thoughts, views, ideas, beliefs. From our history, from our conditioning, who we are, what we are capable of. These things kind of shape who we think we are, how we engage. These things obscure that There's much more freedom and flexibility in the unfolding of our lives than we might think. Maybe we can open to the possibility that we're not what we think we are. Not all those views of this is who I am, this is what I do. And partners and friends. Also, we have these kind of things that they've done in the past. Maybe we think they'll do them again in the future. And so we not only kind of limit ourselves as to who we are and what we can do, we kind of impose those limits on others. And we, you know, we feel this when others do it to us. You know, oh, you're the kind of person who X. And it's like, well, wait a minute, maybe, no. But we do this to ourselves. We do this to ourselves. We create these concepts of who we are, what we're capable of. And these concepts, these views, limit our, and they kind of box us in, they limit our our kind of ability to open to something unexpected about ourselves, or something unexpected about our friends or partners. And this, so a lot of the kind of obscuring of this truth of not knowing comes from our conditioning, our past, our, you know, thoughts from the past kind of influencing what we think is here now. And a similar kind of thing happens going into the future. You know, we think, we kind of project or create an image into the future of what's going to happen, and we kind of believe that. And as I said a few minutes ago, it's like a lot of the times it happens. So we don't really notice that we are obscuring this not knowing with these views, these beliefs, these kind of projections into the future. It's just like we take those things to be, okay, well, that's what's going to happen. When I was in my 30s, I joined the Peace Corps. And, you know, I did some reading about the country I was going to. I was going to the middle of the South Pacific, a little island called Vanuatu that I'd never heard of before I was sent there. And so I'd done a little bit of reading about it and had gotten the information from the Peace Corps and knew the job I'd be working in and knew something about what I was supposed to be doing. But when I was on the plane going across the ocean to the Peace Corps, going to the country of Vanuatu, it was a very odd experience because I had no idea what I was stepping into. I couldn't create any images of what was going to be happening. And in that experience, it kind of felt, it almost felt like the kind of bizarre thing was, almost like, well, I must not going to be going to get there because I can't imagine it. It's almost like I felt like my life was ending because I couldn't fathom what was the next 24 hours. I mean, I could fathom the whole plane ride, but then landing, it's like the whole thing just seemed so mysterious to me. And it was quite an interesting recognition of how much of comfort in my life comes from the sense that I think I know. I think I know what's going to happen. And this experience was so dramatically different that it just almost felt like I was stepping into the abyss. And so this kind of the our minds obscure the not knowing in so many ways, and even right in the present moment. The way our minds work, just our human minds, just the way our human minds work. We tend to live in this present moment, not in the actuality of the present moment, but more in our idea of what it is. This can be maybe not so obvious, but the entirety of our experience, everything that we are experiencing, we don't actually experience what is out there. The way our human system works, our minds create a representation inside, in our brains, basically, in our minds, creates a representation of the world through concept, through perception. This kind of knowing what we've experienced in the past, and, you know, this is, I can recognize what I'm experiencing now based on what I've experienced in the past. So, like sitting here in this room, you know, I can look out and see people and lights and windows, and I can hear what I think are leaf blowers, or maybe it's actually, maybe it's the tree getting cut down, hard to know. So there's this, you know, actually I just see right now, you know, the mind having recognized, oh, maybe it's not leaf blowers, maybe it's something else. The image kind of shifted in my mind about what's going on out there. I had this image of people out there using the leaf blowers, and then it shifted to people by the tree cutting it down. You know, I don't actually know what's out there. I had kind of assumed that I knew. And so we, you know, we relate to experience through our ideas of what's going on, through our concepts. So our minds, you know, create this world. I can see, I recognize chairs and people and zabutons and lights because I've been in touch with them before and because I've had experience with what they are. You know, this is really useful. Like this is a very functional part of our minds that helps us to navigate our world with skill and ease. So, you know, I know that I use the door to walk out of this room. You know, I don't have to think about this. I don't have to figure it out every time. So it's kind of a shortcut, this kind of way that our minds use perception and concept. You know, how much energy it would take if I had to come in here, sit down, it's like, okay, what's happening here? Wow, all this form and color, and oh, those are people. Oh, they're chairs and walls, and that's where I go out. And, you know, if I had to figure that out every time, right now I can sit down and it's like, boom, it's like instantly the mind knows it. It's phenomenal. It's amazing that the mind can do that. And so it's like these concepts are a great shortcut for us. They help us to live our lives without expending so much energy every moment. Like every concept is like a little shortcut. Helps us to navigate the world. So they're really useful. But what we don't recognize often is that we are, you know, because they're so useful, because they're so habitual, that we are living our lives mediated through concept. And we're not actually connecting with the actual experience. We're not connecting with the actual experience. We're connecting with the experience that our mind is making. And so this also obscures the not knowing. Because when we meet experience through concept, we think we know how concepts function. You know, some simple thing. You know, when concepts, when the functioning of our concept is surprised or is, it doesn't work the way we think it does, we get startled. Like we look at a chair and it's like, yeah, that's a chair and I can sit in it. And then maybe we sit down in it and suddenly it collapses because the legs weren't attached. It was a chair in progress. It wasn't actually a fully made chair. And so the concept can kind of get in the way of actually being with what is here. These are kind of silly examples in some way, but just trying to get some of the point across about how concepts work. You know, concepts, again, you know, really useful. We can begin perhaps to notice how they obscure what's going on and that we're kind of living through those concepts instead of really with the experience, with the actual experience. When our perception makes a mistake, when this process of our mind makes a mistake, attributes something, attributes the wrong concept to an experience. This doesn't happen, maybe it happens more often than we think, perhaps, but it may not kind of startle us that often, or it may not matter that much that we've made that mistake. But there are times when we can, especially in our meditation, we can really see this. We can recognize, wow, the mind had created a whole story around this concept. And then we discover that the concept was completely wrong. So I was in Burma meditating at Shwe Umin, Masaido Otejaniya, and I was there for probably 6-7 weeks, something like that, and so it was quite a long time, and I kind of got familiar with the routines and rhythms of the day and the kind of village life that, you know, the rhythms and routines of village life that I could hear. My room was pretty near the wall of the monastery, and sounds come over the wall, and so I kind of got familiar with some of the rhythms and routines. And many evenings while I was meditating, I began hearing this kind of squealing sound, and that sound in my perception, my mind perceived that squealing sound as a pig. That was the kind of squealing sounds I'd heard in the past. So this is classic, the mind recognizing experience. It goes off and kind of looks in its memory banks and says, what's this sound familiar to? Like the sound of the leaf blowers, you know? It's like, that sounds like leaf blowers. But I don't really know if it's leaf blowers. So the mind identified it as a pig squealing. And I just kept hearing it night after night. And at some point during this regular evening hearing of this squealing sound, my mind decided that this squealing sound was particularly distressed. So my mind created this image or this idea that on the other side of the wall was the village butcher. And that every evening, what was going on was that the pig was being slaughtered for the next day's market. So that's what my mind did. Now, I knew that was, I didn't know. I knew that I did not know that was what was going on. And yet that was kind of what was going on in my mind. And there was a compassion that arose for this pig that was being slaughtered. So each night I just felt that. You know, again, knowing, I kind of knew that I didn't know. So there was the understanding that I did not really know if this is what was going on. And then one night, instead of meditating in my room at that time, I decided to do a walking meditation. So I was doing walking and up and down the center of the monastery at Shwe Umin. It's about a quarter mile, just walking back and forth. And I began experiencing these kind of bats that were just flying like right close to me. They were just like, you know, they'd come and veer off and veer off. And as they'd come in, they were like, they were squealing. I was like, oh, that's what that sound is. So I had realized that I didn't know whether it was a pig being slaughtered. But my mind had completely bought in to the fact that it was a pig. When it kind of was like this, it's like, it's not even a pig. That was kind of a shocking thing. It's like, wow, this is what the mind can do. It's like it created the idea of the pig. It created the idea of the pig being slaughtered. It created the compassion. I mean, like the compassion just like completely, no need for the compassion anymore. There's no pig. There's... So not seeing that this is the way our minds work, we believe we live through our concepts. And so we begin to look more deeply at our experience. As we begin to look more deeply at our experience, we can begin to see that these concepts are concepts. You know, we're not trying to get rid of concepts because they're so useful. But it is really helpful to know that it is a concept. Like using the concept functionally, but knowing that it's not the reality. You know, concepts come with so much baggage. Because, you know, our concepts come not just with the simple idea of chair. That's a very simple concept. But, you know, the concept of person or man or woman or older person or younger person or, you know, these concepts, they come with our history. They come with our views and ideas attached to them. How we feel about them is not just about what's here. It's informed by the whole like baggage that comes along with that concept, the whole set of conditioning that has been around those experiences when we've had those experiences in the past, when we've met with those kinds of people or experiences. We've been shaped by those experiences and those memories, like it's kind of like they get connected to, you know, like this is the way conditioning works. We maybe experience something repeatedly in connection with it's like Pavlov's, you know, Pavlov's training around pairing the giving of food with the bell, you know, so the bell then will elicit the salivation. So our minds will associate experiences. And so we don't just meet experience cleanly. We tend to meet it with our conditioning along, coming along with it. Anais Nin, I think, is the one who said, we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. We see it through our filters, through our views, through our conditioning. And the concepts kind of come along with that conditioning. The conditioning kind of gets attached to those concepts. And so it's really, really helpful to begin to notice all of this, to notice that we are seeing experience through concept, that concept is connected with history. And so perhaps seeing somebody of a particular height and kind of shape on the street in the distance. You know, maybe we have an instant kind of sense of liking or not liking of that person. We know nothing about them. We kind of get to see this in our retreats too. It's like, you know, we don't know much about each other, but we create the stories about people, and some of those are based on our history. And so we see somebody in the distance with a particular shape and instant kind of sense of, oh, I like that person, or, oh, I don't like that person. I'm afraid of that person. And, you know, maybe that association or the reasoning there is because of an association of maybe a person with that particular shape kind of was either particularly kind or particularly cruel to us. And so there's a resonance of that. So we carry that into the experience. It's not, we are not just meeting the experience in the world as it is. So this to me kind of recalls the teaching that the Buddha offered to Bahiya. This is a kind of a famous teaching. Bahiya was a monastic, an ascetic, who was kind of practicing on his own, pretty far away from where the Buddha was. And he apparently, this is the story goes, he apparently had the thought one day, gee, I wonder if I'm enlightened. And it is said that one of his relatives who was kind of a deity, noticed his relative having this thought and kind of went down and said, kind of entered into his consciousness and said, you know, no, you're not enlightened. And not only that, you are not even on the path to enlightenment. But if you're interested, there's this guy up north, the Buddha, and he can show you the way. So Bahiya, having gotten this transmission from his relative, walked thousands of miles, I think, maybe hundreds, hundreds of miles to find the Buddha. And when he got there, he got to the place where he'd heard the Buddha was living, and the people in the monastery said, well, the Buddha's out for alms round. So Bahiya kind of followed off after the Buddha to find him on alms round, and found him and kind of interrupted his alms round and said, will you give me a teaching? Please give me a teaching. And the Buddha said, you know, this is not the time. This is not the time, Bahiya. I'm on alms round. And Bahiya said, he invoked impermanence, actually. He said, we don't know how long you're going to live, and we don't know how long I'm going to live. Please give me a teaching. And the second time, the Buddha said, you know, this is not the time. I'm getting lunch. And Bahiya asked a third time. And the third time, and this is kind of in the suttas, almost every time somebody asks the Buddha something three times, he'll stop and he'll do what the person is asking. And so at this point he stops and he says, okay, I'll give you a brief teaching. So the other night somebody said, maybe you could just read to us one of these teachings that got people enlightened. Well, this is one of those. So listen. Because it is said that after hearing this, Bahiya became fully awakened. And so this speaks to the kind of the conditions of Bahia's mind, that he could receive this and understand it so fully. Most of us spend a lot of years kind of massaging this teaching and beginning to understand little bits of it. So this teaching, the Buddha said, actually Bahiya said, please give me a teaching in brief. He wanted a pithy teaching. So I think I have this pretty well memorized. So I don't have it in front of me, but I think I've got it pretty well memorized. So the Buddha said, Bahia, this is how you should train yourself. In the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. In the sensed is only the sensed. In the cognized is only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. So that was the instruction he gave Bahia. There's a little more, which I'll give you in a moment. But it's kind of, you know, just looking at, or he's pointing to what we could call bare attention, knowing experience as experience, knowing seeing as seeing, knowing hearing as hearing. In the seen is only the seen, not kind of wrapped around with concepts and views and ideas. Just seeing. And the heard is only the heard. One of the interesting pieces, I think, here too, is the in the cognized is only the cognized. So the first three, in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed. Those are basically our physical senses. Seeing, hearing, and sensing includes touching, smelling, tasting. Our physical sense experience. In our physical sense experience is only the physical sense experience. But then there's also the inclusion of in the cognized is only the cognized. So that brings in the kind of the recognition or the understanding of, oh, here's a thought. This is a perception. This is a concept. This is a view. This is being believed right now. So it's not that we like become these like robots, but we understand that what is arising in our minds is an arising in our minds. This concept is a concept as it kind of popped into my mind with that the bat squealing, it's like that was a concept. That it was a pig was a concept. It was an idea. It was a perception that was wrong. In the moment, in the moments when I was perceiving it as pig, I was not really aware. As I mentioned, I was aware that I was making up the story around the slaughtering going on. I was not aware that I was making up the concept of pig. And so this is what the Buddha is pointing to. No concept as concept. No views as views, thoughts as thoughts. This doesn't mean that we can't engage with our thoughts. We can't know the content of our thoughts and engage with it. I mean, the Buddha, the mind of the Buddha is said is like this, understanding things in this way. And the Buddha lived his life. You know, he went on alms round. He got his food. He ate his food. You know, he gave talks, he had conversations with Ananda. You know, he did all of these things. He had a life. It wasn't that he just kind of became, and the seen is only the seen. There's a way in which we can know that and live our lives. So, to continue in the seen. This is how you should train yourself. So that's the instruction. That's how we practice. We practice recognizing, oh, this is seeing. This is the experience of hearing. This is the experience of a thought arising. So we practice that. And that begins to help us to understand experience in a different way. And so the Buddha goes on. So he says, when for you, Bahia, in the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, in the sensed is only the sensed, in the cognized is only the cognized. Then there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, this is freedom. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor in between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. And so I find it interesting that he started with, here's how you train yourself. This is the practice that we work with. Just simple, a simple instruction. You know, a sentence, a couple sentences to offer the instructions. And then he says, and here's what happens. So he didn't give Bahia a teaching on not self. He said, no seeing as seeing, hearing as hearing. What's cognized is what's cognized. When experience is known in that way, you will understand there is not self, because we understand this process nature of experience. And so this is a pointer in some ways, you know, just like we don't have to try to find not self. You know, it's an insight, it's an understanding that happens through the meeting of experience in this way, this meeting where we recognize it's not going to be completely unmediated, but we're going to understand it is mediated. It is a mediated experience through our minds. And so this kind of exploration, really I would say this teaching, this sentence, in the seen is only the seen. This is how we train ourselves. In the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. The Buddha gave it to Bahia in a sentence. We're saying that over and over and over and over and over again this week. That's all that we're saying over and over again this week, in different ways, from different perspectives. So this is the teaching that we're offering. This is the practice, the simple practice. Are you aware? What is it? What are you aware of? And so as we enter into that, we begin to really recognize that our ideas, our views, our opinions, our beliefs have been just completely obscuring what this experience is, what this is, this humanness is. And so this investigation really enters, we can look at it almost as an investigation or an entering into the willingness to have that kind of not knowing, that I don't know what's going to happen. You know, coming back to this story of Bahia, I like this kind of two-part teaching. It's like, this is what we explore, this is how we engage, and this is what we might understand. But he didn't really point to, and this would be the experience. I mean, he said, you know, you will understand there is no you in terms of that. No, you know, in terms of seeing. There's not an I who sees, not one who sees. The nature of understanding, the nature of insight, is that we, again, this is in the realm of not knowing, we have no idea what we are looking for. We think we're looking for some kind of experience or, you know, enlightenment. We might have some idea about what enlightenment's like, or, but we have no idea. And so entering into this kind of place of not knowing, you know, we really enter into the realm of the unfamiliar. We don't know. So when I was on my first 3-month retreat, I heard a lot of talks describing certain kinds of meditative experiences, and they sounded pretty cool. I wanted to have them. And really particularly around one, I was like, you know, kind of aiming towards that experience and so wanted to have it. So much suffering around wanting to have that experience and looking for it and trying to find it. It's like, again, I had no idea what I was looking for. But at one point, as I was doing this walking meditation, just noticing kind of the suffering around this wanting to have this experience, I noticed that I was having a fantasy in my mind around having an interview with my teacher and telling my teacher that I'd had the experience. And, you know, we were kind of laughing and celebrating, and this was the fantasy in the mind, and I saw this, you know, so this is like, oh, this is actually what I want. You know, I don't know what that experience is, but what I want is to be able to tell my teacher that I've had it so that they can tell me I'm a good yogi. I was like, phew. Again, realizing, you know, I had no idea. I did not know what I was wanting. And so we tend to be, you know, this kind of place of entering into the not knowing can be a little uncomfortable as we actually begin to recognize moment to moment, I don't know the next thing that's going to happen. It can be a little uncomfortable. I feel a little bit unstable. Because our minds really like to have the sense of, I know the next thing I'm going to land in. And so when we really recognize that we don't know that, and that's a truth, actually, we don't know. It's not that meditation changes that. It's just that it strips away the delusion that we think we know. Nothing changes, except that delusion goes away. But that delusion going away can be very uncomfortable. Can feel really uncomfortable. Sometimes there's fear, confusion. A feeling of vulnerability. And so it's really important to recognize, well, that too actually is just another arising. You know, it is just fear arising, perhaps a sense of vulnerability is an arising. Now, the vulnerability connected with this truth of not knowing, the impermanent, uncontrollable nature of experience, very natural to have this sense of vulnerability. It's not a problem. It's actually, we can hold it with some compassion. And there doesn't have to be a constriction around it. And yet often there is. There is the fear, the vulnerability. I think the vulnerability, that kind of recognition, there's not a lot of control. Everything is changing. I have no idea what the next moment will be. Vulnerability is a truth. And then we react to that vulnerability with fear. Sometimes that that fear is actually not so much about the really direct moment meeting of, wow, I have no idea what the next moment will be. But it's more of a kind of a projection into the future, or kind of a recognition. I don't know. You know, so there's a kind of a projection that something bad is going to happen, or the not knowing is somehow inherently a problem or something like that, that we have a relationship to that. At one point doing some walking meditation, or it was a retreat where I was really kind of in this terrain of realizing that each moment was like, wow, I have no idea what the next moment will be. And I was misinterpreting it in a way. I thought I didn't know what this moment was. It's like I thought I didn't know anything. And I think this maybe can be a way we get confused around this truth of the as we recognize we don't know what the next moment will be, we somehow bring that back into this moment and think we aren't knowing what this moment is. So it sends us into a kind of tailspin that way. And that's where I was. It's like a lot of fear, a lot of confusion. And so one evening I decided, okay, I'm gonna go meet this fear. I'm gonna go meet this insecurity of the what is not known. I want to just meet this not knowing. And so I took a step. And the step was known. The lifting. The next step was known. It's like, wow, it's known. This is, the mind can know this. It's like the mind in that moment kind of landed here instead of projecting into the future. I'm not going to know what the next moment is. Oh no. It's like, I'm here. The mind knows this. And I was like, each moment stepping, it's known, it's known, it's known. That was a place almost of refuge, even though as it was changing moment to moment, and I didn't know what the next moment was. Kind of, it was like the sense of the feeling in that walking meditation was that every single step, I was taking a step into the abyss. And then the foot landed. And where was I? I was standing on the edge of the abyss. Another step. Willing to take a step into the abyss. And then I'm left again on the edge of the abyss. That is a kind of trust. We're willing to step into the unknown that grows with practice, takes some time. And yet, in this moment, it's known. Seeing is known, hearing is known. It's almost another kind of experience that was kind of an expanding. It's like, I think what partly too we think about, I don't know what the next moment will be. It's like, we just know this split second. There's the mind kind of goes, this is just nothing. It's vanishing immediately. It's like, so again, it doesn't feel like there's any place to kind of land in some way. And yet really deeply entering into that space of just this moment. And there's not even a moment. I mean, it's just this mutation. It's just this mutating kind of changing. There's nothing solid or stable in it at all. But just landing in that, or not landing in it, maybe slipping with it, falling with it, is the more the feeling. It's like they're just like, yeah, this is this changing, mutating moment It's like that moment is huge. The endless now. That's what we're living in. This endless now that's just shifting, changing, mutating. Let's sit for a moment.